Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest, 2, 1.
Welcome to this latest edition of Network Europe. I'm Kate Hairson. Coming up on the program this week, British police in Moscow investigate the murder of a former Russian spy. Romania's EU entry leaves its tiny neighbour Moldova stuck between West and East. Romanian villagers sue Borat for making fun of them. And we take a look at the winners of the annual Alternative Nobel Prize. These stories and more, plus our December quiz, are coming up, so stay tuned. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that relations between his country and Britain were unaffected by the British police investigation into the murder of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko. His comments came as British police officers in Moscow conducted interviews with key witnesses about the bizarre poisoning case. Deutsche Welle's Bill Gasparini has more from the Russian capital.
British police officials say the investigation must be treated as a murder case given the circumstances of the death of Alexander Litvinenko, who died on November 23rd. Several police investigators are now in Moscow, where they have talked with Dmitry Kovtun, one of three Russians who met Litvinenko in London on November 1st, the day he began to feel sick. No details have emerged from the testimony given by Kovtun. Litvinenko died a slow, agonizing death after he was poisoned with polonium-210, a deadly radioactive substance that police say is very difficult to obtain. The 43-year-old was a former member of Russia's intelligence services who fled into exile in London, from where he became a fierce critic of the Kremlin. The British police are also due to talk soon with Kovtun's colleague Andrei Lugovoy, who has hinted he may have more information to disclose about the case. Lugovoy has long denied involvement in any plot to kill Litvinenko. However, he is considered a key witness because traces of radiation have been found on two planes in which he flew to and from London. Minute traces of radiation have also been found at the British Embassy in Moscow, where Lugovoy came to give testimony last month after the inquiry first began. Lugovoy has given various interviews since the poisoning case broke, always to deny he had any interest in killing Litvinenko. He says the meeting in London was only to discuss business matters. Lugovoy is also a former Russian intelligence agent and one-time presidential bodyguard who now runs a drinks company in Moscow. Another key witness who also met Litvinenko in London, Italian Mario Scaramella, did test positive with traces of polonium-210, although of a low level. The use of polonium has led investigators to suspect possible high-level Russian involvement, if not by the Kremlin, then what police call rogue elements from within the Russian intelligence agencies. The Kremlin has firmly denied any involvement in the poisoning of Litvinenko, although he issued a statement from his deathbed accusing President Vladimir Putin of ordering his killing. The British police are working under restrictions announced by Russia's Prosecutor General Yuri Chaika. They are not allowed to question witnesses directly, but must work through Russian police officers. The British will also not be able to arrest anyone they suspect of involvement in the murder or take them back to London for trial. Chaika says this would be against Russian law, and there is no extradition treaty between Russia and Great Britain. British officials have objected to the restrictions as being contrary to international standards, but have decided to proceed with their work as best they can. Bill Gasparini, Moscow.
Moldova, the poorest country in Europe, used to belong to Romania until it was incorporated into the Soviet Union at the close of World War II. In 1991, the tiny country with just over 4 million inhabitants declared its independence and went its own post-Soviet way. Now, with Romania's entry into the EU, Moldova sits between West and East. And as Radio France International's Nick Champeau found out in Moldova, this is not always a comfortable position.
Okay.
Our night train to Chisinau will be held up at the border between Romania and Moldova for another 2 hours. The time it takes to lift the entire train and change all the wheels. Because as in Russia, the rail tracks in Moldova are not compatible with standard European trains. Opinion polls show that 65% of the population of the Republic of Moldova favor European integration. In the Pushkin Park in the heart of the capital, Chisinau, many strollers told us they'll be like children in front of a candy store when their neighbor, Romania, joins the European club next year.
I think it's a good thing for Romania, but for us, Romania's EU membership will make things more difficult because we'll need a visa to go there. We'll be more isolated.
I would have liked Moldova to join the EU, but it's impossible given the government we have today. It's a communist government. They're old-fashioned.
Romania is going to join the EU on the 1st of January. What will it change for you?
It will affect me because it will be harder for me to travel to Romania, but deep down I'm happy that Romania is joining the Union, and I hope that one day we will follow the steps of Romania and join the European bloc ourselves.
From January the 1st, Romania's 600-kilometer-long border with Moldova will become one of the Union's new external frontiers, hence tightened security measures and the introduction of visas. These will be free, but it's nonetheless tough on Moldova, as the country has a majority population of ethnic Romanians. Hundreds of thousands of Moldovans have applied for Romanian citizenship, and hundreds of thousands have left and are still leaving the country, setting up shop in Western Europe, mainly Spain and Italy. Moldova is the poorest nation in Europe. There is no Italian consulate in Chisinau, so every day, hordes of people hop on minivans for a 12-hour drive to the Romanian capital, Bucharest, to queue patiently in front of the Italian consulate. That's where we met Valentina, a 50-year-old university teacher. She tells us why she is returning to Italy to work as a maid.
When I was working as a teacher in Moldova, in the capital, Chisinau, I earned a miserable wage, miserable, 20 euros a month for a Romanian literature teacher. In Italy, I work as a maid, and I get paid 800 euros, 20 times more.
Moldova's EU membership is a long way off. In fact, it may never happen. The sensitive issue of the enclave of Transnistria is partly why Brussels is not considering the case seriously. The country would also be required to crack down on corruption and organized crime. Dumitru Bragiș is former prime minister and chairman of the opposition Party of Social Democracy. Bragiș says that in any case, the ruling Communist Party has never sent Brussels a clear signal that it wanted to join. He adds that in the meantime, Moscow has been an unreliable trade partner.
Unfortunately, Moldova now have big problems in its trade regime with European countries and has big problem with Russia. We have an increasing of prices for imports from Russia, like gas. Unfortunately, in this case, we didn't receive any support from other countries, from European Union, from United States. And now I think that Moldova unfortunately became a Cuba of Europe. This is because of the irresponsible policies of the Moldovan government.
In 2001, Moldova was the first former member of the Eastern Bloc to have elected a communist president after the bloc was dismantled. Dorin Chirtuaca is deputy chairman of another opposition party, the Liberal Party. He accuses Moldova's president, Vladimir Voronin, of acting like old guard authoritarian leaders. Inspired by Russia's Vladimir Putin, Voronin has instructed prosecutor generals to tighten the grip on non-governmental organizations.
The prosecutors have to check the activity of the NGOs regarding the organization and on developing of the public manifestations and other protests. Especially they should see which are the financial sources and the propagandistic support.
So how would you sum up this this questionnaire? What does it tell us about the intentions of the government?
To try to keep under control the entire society of Moldova. So they want to maintain the same type of appearance of freedom that we've had during the Soviet times.
The next national elections in Moldova are due in 2009. In Bucharest, Petre Roman, who became Romania's first post-World War II democratic prime minister in 1991, says it's a shame that Romania and Moldova do not join the EU as one country.
We missed that opportunity. As a prime minister in 1991, I tried to prepare the ground for a union. Unfortunately, the attitude of too many politicians in Romania was patronizing Moldova instead of discussing with them on equal footing, discussing with them as equals. That was a big mistake. There are a lot of problems of the residuals of the Soviet times, and they have a very difficult situation. Now Moldova is really in a very difficult situation. Remember that Moldova was never a state, and I still have doubts about the viability of the mechanism and institutions of that state now.
Liliana Vitsu works for the Chișinău branch of the Eurasia NGO. She is more optimistic. She hopes that Moldova will reap the benefits of its neighbors' new EU status.
People will be very close to what Europe is about. They will just basically need to cross the frontier, which takes them only 2 hours, you know, and experience Europe by themselves. By the fact that people will see and what the EU is about. Myself, I very much hope that, you know, those who share skepticism or those who are Eurosceptics or who are not EU-driven, you know, that they will realize the importance of being in the club and not outside the club, and that therefore they will come out, they will exert pressure and higher pressure on the government to undertake necessary reforms in order to move closer to the EU.
In the meantime, this week, the EU's External Relations Commissioner, Benita Ferreira-Waldner, called on EU member states to boost their level of cooperation with countries such as Georgia and Moldova. She said that the relations between Brussels and its new neighbors should go beyond free trade agreements. Nick Champeau, Chișinău, Network Europe.
And staying in the region, here in Network Europe, we go to a small Romanian village called Glod, which is in the Carpathian Mountains. The village was made famous, or perhaps I should say infamous, by the Borat film. The town was the location for scenes from the 20th century Fox film, in which the Kazakhstani journalist Borat, aka Sacha Baron Cohen, shows off his hometown before wreaking havoc across the United States. But Glod's newfound fame has left local residents, many of whom were extras in the film, feeling like they've been dragged through the mud. They've engaged a duo of high-profile lawyers in the hope of winning damages to the tune of 30 million euros. Carl Holm has more.
This my town of Kusak. This Orkin, the town rapist.
Glod means literally mud, and mud is the name of a poor village on the edge of the Carpathians. In Glod, even if the main street was tarred, there wouldn't be too many people who could afford to drive a car along it. The town has just 1,500 inhabitants, Romani people, who even in Romania are vilified as gypsies. The town is made up of small stone houses, some of which appear to be sinking into the mud, but others with small tidy front gardens and firewood stacked for the winter. A young man in a cheap leather jacket makes no secret of his anger.
He wanted me to dance with him, to have this role in the film. He promised me a lot of money.
Toader Moise got just 10 euro for his troubles. to others unemployed, uneducated, and supports a wife and child with around €100 per month. Inside the small bar in Glod, the men argue over a card game and beers. When the topic turns to Borat, they become enraged, shouting that only some of the people in the town profited from the film. Nikolai Staichu, a local municipal council member for the Romani political party, told how he got €100 for helping out with the film. But he said the film company deceived the people of Glod.
It is like a zoo, but more fun, because instead of just look at animals, you can also shoot them in the head with a gun.
These movie people first came to talk to us at the town hall. We couldn't sign a contract with them, though. We first had to ask the people if they wanted to be part of this, for example, letting a cow into the house and so forth. Then the film people just bypassed us and went straight to the townspeople. They told them they were making a documentary film. There was no talk of a film like Borat, which would portray the whole town as criminals, thieves and bandits, as people who sleep in their houses with animals and drink from the toilet.
Nikolai Stauciu was horrified when he heard what had been done in the film. Biridon Shureba is another complainant from the village. He hasn't seen the film either, but an acquaintance told him about it.
I also acted in the film. What he made out of me is a lie. He took a simple welder and presented him as an abortion doctor. He made me into a criminal. That hurt me a lot, and I'm not going to let this lie. I have a wife and four children, and many grandchildren. Here it's not about money, it's about honour. That's what I must defend. That's my right.
Now, with top-notch lawyers Michael Vitti in Germany and Ed Fagan in New York, they are suing 20th Century Fox for €30 million for discriminating against the Romani people in Glod. One thing is for sure, they could use the money. Many children in Glod don't go to school on a regular basis and will probably stay just as poor as their parents. Karl Holm, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Happy time. Thank you.
And now to something completely different. The psychedelic drug LSD is usually associated with the hippie flower power era in the West in the late 1960s. But few people know that thousands of tests involving LSD were carried out in Czechoslovakia. These tests took place from the mid-1950s until the 1970s. Canadian journalist R.M. Crockford is currently in Prague researching the country's LSD testing program, which he says was possibly the biggest conducted anywhere in the world. Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby asked him why the testing was carried out.
LSD was discovered in 1943 in Switzerland, and after the war was over, there was this sort of widespread belief everywhere in that chemistry was a miracle that would sort of save the planet, that all sorts of, you know, food production, everything would be sort of revolutionized by chemistry, and psychiatry was one more sort of aspect of that. So in Czechoslovakia, there were scientists that were, you know, sort of regularly experimenting with new substances that would just come on the market. And Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland, which had patented LSD at the time, sent some here. And one of the doctors, a man named Jerzy Rubicek, was interested in sort of the, you know, possible effects it could have. But no one really knew, not even Sandoz knew at the time, what it was really good for. They knew it was very powerful, but they didn't really know how it would be useful. So they actually asked doctors, if you can find some use for this, great. So there were many different projects. There were some where they created so-called model psychosis to try to understand schizophrenia. There was this belief at the time that schizophrenic patients were undergoing a kind of permanent acid trip. So they thought that If psychologists or psychiatrists, medical students could experience the same thing, then they would understand schizophrenia better.
Were the communist authorities aware of what was going on, that people were taking or being given LSD in Czechoslovakia?
Well, the communists certainly were aware of it because it was manufactured by the state pharmaceutical company SPOFA from about 1963 until 1974. And also the Czech army used it in some experiments in the late 1960s because they were afraid that it was actually going to be used as a chemical weapon by the United States. So they actually performed some experiments on soldiers, and there are films of that. They didn't have any problem with any of this research because the doctors were very careful to frame it in very mechanistic terms, that you had a problem, you applied a chemical to it, and then the problem was solved. And as long as it was phrased that way, it was fine. And there was no, it didn't, the drug never leaked out onto the street, so there was no social problem they had to deal with like they did in the West.
I know you're still doing your research and still looking for people who took LSD during these tests. But from what you know so far, what kind of impact did the drug have on these guinea pigs?
Well, I mean, it was for everybody who took it, it was an overwhelming experience. The big question is whether it was overwhelmingly positive or overwhelmingly negative. And for the people it was whom it was overwhelmingly positive, they are generally willing to talk about it. But the people who were really traumatized by it, who had a bad set of circumstances, either because of what their own frame of mind was or the kind of circumstances that they had it in, it's still a very sort of sensitive private matter. And this is why this, you know, trying to find such people and being able to talk to them is a complicated and long-term process.
Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby there talking to Canadian journalist R.M. Crockford about LSD testing in Czechoslovakia. This week in Sweden, all eyes have been on the Nobel Prize laureates who have been attending a dizzying round of concerts, dinners and press conferences in the lead-up to the award ceremony on Sunday in Stockholm. But there's another group of worthy winners in Stockholm this week. They're picking up an award known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. Radio Sweden's Dave Russell met up with the winners of the Right Livelihood Award.
Now in its 26th year, the Right Livelihood Award is a prize given for outstanding vision and work on behalf of the planet and its people. Past winners have included Bianca Jagger and Astrid Lindgren. It's usually shared between four recipients, one of whom this year, Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked secret Pentagon papers during the Vietnam War, made a few headlines at a news conference in Stockholm on Wednesday when he said that he believed the United States would attack Iran before 2008 and urged Washington insiders to make new disclosures to prevent a new war.
I believe that there is a real chance for the publics of the world, and Europe in particular, to help avert an American attack on Iran. And I think there's a bigger chance of doing that from opinion abroad than there really is at home. In America, I am pressing officials, insiders, who know that this attack is planned and would be catastrophic. And we know that there are such officials because they have leaked anonymously to Seymour Hersh and to others. And I'm urging them to go beyond these fragmentary and anonymous leaks to be of public testimony and to put out voluminous documents that will demonstrate that the White House actually intends what they say, to attack Iran and possibly to use nuclear weapons.
You spoke about those insiders. You're asking them to take that big step, a big step that you took all those years ago.
I am asking them to leak, to give unauthorized disclosure of documents on the scale of the Pentagon Papers. That means thousands of pages. But to do it, unlike me, before the war, before the bombs have fallen, before a nuclear attack has occurred. Afterwards, it's very much harder to stop a juggernaut, to stop a war machine that is in process. But I think there's a much better chance of stopping an Iran war before it gets started.
The 75-year-old, who was honored for his efforts to expose government deception worldwide, also said European allies and governments should put pressure on the Bush administration by pledging to withdraw from NATO if the United States or Israel uses nuclear weapons against Iran.
I'm urging, and I'm happy to have this opportunity because of the prize, to urge this in Europe, that the public understands that a first use of nuclear weapons in particular would be a catastrophe for the humanity, that they should urge their governments to say this clearly to the U.S. in advance of the war. rather than think of resigning after the attack or of doing anything after the attack, I would rather see the government saying before the attack clearly not only that threats against Iran are illegitimate and wrongful, totally and dangerous, but that carrying out such threats, especially with nuclear weapons, would lead to the dissolution of NATO.
Ellsberg shared the 2 million krona award with Indian women's rights activist Ruth Manorama and a poetry festival in Colombia. Anti-corruption campaigner Chico Whitaker Ferreira of Brazil won the honorary award for a lifetime's dedicated work for social justice that has strengthened democracy in Brazil and helped give birth to the World Social Forum, which he said helped show that another world is possible.
The first idea is to say that another world is possible. That's to say what we see here, what we see everywhere, what we see in the world, inequality, wars, diseases, endemic, and so on, is not necessary. We could have another world.
Ruth Manorama said that she hoped the award would shed more light on the plight of the Dalit women and the injustices caused by the Indian caste system.
Their oppression is triple. They face triple alienation on the basis of class, caste, and gender. They are the poorest of the poor. And as women, they face violence from the dominant caste people as well as men from their own community. Being outcast women, Dalits is really the outcast. The outcast women, on the basis of caste discrimination, they face very severe violences. So caste, class, and gender, you know, compounded in their life and make the situation much more worse. By all standards, they are very poor, most illiterate, bonded laborers in the community, women who are pushed into prostitution in the name of religion, many such violences. So I would say that, you know, they are thrice alienated as Dalit women. This award itself is given to me on building organization to counter the caste discrimination and caste atrocities. It would be good that we would see the caste can end like racism. Like the apartheid in South Africa, it is possible because it's not God-made, it's not divined, it's man's action, so that they can appropriate wealth, they can appropriate power, they can appropriate socio-economic, you know, every status. So I think that by recognizing and giving me this award, many women in this community can get a lot of support.
All four received their awards in the Swedish Parliament.
That was Radio Sweden's David Russell with the report on the Right Livelihood Awards. Well, that's it for the program today, but before we go, here's the Network Europe December quiz.
There is a wealth of Christmas customs around Europe, some dating back hundreds of years. In a particular Nordic country, so-called Yule Brothers, visit farms and towns during the 13 days leading up to Christmas. They're strange creatures, part troll, part prankster in human form.
They come to town one by one 13 nights before Christmas. And if the children are well behaved and go early to bed, they receive a gift in their shoe. If they're not well behaved, they receive a rotten potato.
We want you to tell us in which European country naughty children get rotten potatoes in the run-up to Christmas. Email your answers to contact@networkeurope.org. We have 5 Christmas presents to give away and we'll announce the winners at the end of the month. The question again, in which Nordic country do the so-called Yule Brothers distribute rotten potatoes to naughty children?
The email address again, that's contact@networkeurope.org, or visit our website at networkeurope.org. We always like to hear from you. Network Europe receives funding from the European Union and is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Prague, Radio Slovenia International, and Deutsche Welle. On behalf of our pan-European team, I'm Kate Hairsine saying thanks for tuning in, and I'm leaving you with the song Brazil by the Greek hip-hop band Imiskubria.
Είχα πιει το τρίτο κατσαβίδι.
βραζιλιάνικο στολίδι. Ήταν Εύα και το σώμα της το φίδι. Μα τη για μήλο πήρα ένα πίδι. Μαργαριτάρι μαύρο μες στο στρίδι. Βάζει σανίδι και στο γκάζι πριονίδι. Είμαι δίμον στο παιχνίδι. Και αφήνω τον καφέ για το λουμίδι. Δίχως σκέψη, σηκώνω φρύδι. Τρέχω δίπλα της και της μιλάω ήδη. Δώσ' της καρδιά σου το αντικλείδι. Έχω πετάξει μαζί σου σαν το γονίδι. Μου λέει τι είπες, ρε σαν μια μύδι. Σαν να φάγα στη μάπα ένα μπουνίδι. Η Μπραζιλέρο εγκατακλείδι. Με φύσηξε σαν να μ' αποκαίδι. Είσαι απ' την Βραζίλ, είμαι απ' τα ίμι. Είσαι πολύ κορμί, μου βγήκαν οι οφθαλμοί. Είσαι απ' την Βραζίλ, είμαι απ' τα ίμι. Μπήκαμε στο ζουμί, μα έφαγα παρακμή. Είσαι απ' την Βραζίλ, είμαι απ' τα ίμι. Είσαι πολύ κορμί, μου βγήκαν οι οφθαλμοί. Είσαι απ' τη Βραζίλ, είμαι απ' τα ίμι. Μπήκαμε στο ζουμί, μα έφαγα παρακμή.
Κάτσε να δεις φίλε μου με τζέλο τώρα πως γίνεται η κατάσταση. Uno, dos, tres. Να 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 να, κόμπα καμπάνα. Και στο χέρι κοχύμπα, κούμπα χαβάνα. Κι έχω χορούμι και πίτσα μεξικάνα. Μπρος μου χορεύει καυτή βραζιλιάνα. Ήταν τσικίτα, τρελή μπανάνα. Το κούναγε σαν να ήταν ζαργάνα. Ούτε σιλφίδα, ούτε ταρτάνα. Το τέλειο κορμί, λατινοαμερικάνα. Με ξυπνάει απ' την Ιρβάνα. Το φλάουτο, θεότα του πάνα. Λαμπερμάνα, μαλαγάνα. Στο καμάκι με παλιά καραβάνα. Διασήμος ράπερ, φορώ μπαντάνα. Θες να γίνεις το παιδιό μου η μάνα. Το ταπεδίχθη, γλωσσοκοπάνα. Μου λέει, τι και τα τσευγάλω στο Τατιάνα. Έφαγα πίκρα και καμπάνα. Η μαγική τσατσάρα έγινε τσουγκράνα. Μα δεν με ξέρει, ρε κοτσάνα. Τώρα μόνο σκροταλίζω τη ροκάνα. Είσαι απ' τη Βραζίλ, είμαι απ' τα ίμι. Είσαι πολύ κορμί, μου βγήκαν οι οφθαλμοί. Είσαι απ' τη Βραζίλ, είμαι απ' τα ίμι. Μπήκαμε στο ζουμί, μα έφαγα παρακμή. Είσαι απ'